Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Laura Ling and Yuna Lee, the two American journalists freed by North Korea, spoke this morning in Los Angeles saying they fully expected to go to a labor camp to serve their 12-year sentence when they were asked to go to a meeting.
We were taken to a location, and when we walked in through the doors, we saw standing before us President Bill Clinton.
Laura Ling speaking, both women welcomed by families, including Yuna Lee's 5-year-old daughter and their boss, former vice president, now cable TV owner, Al Gore. Aidan Foster Carter is an expert on Korea and honorary senior research fellow at Leeds University in England. Aidan, obviously overwhelming, but is it really a surprise that these young women are freed?
It's a partial surprise, but I don't think it's a complete surprise. It was fairly clear that they were hostages. I mean, no doubt to be captured in North Korea is a very worrying experience. Having said that, we are also told, or people are saying, that while they were held, as far as we know, in a guest house in Pyongyang, these two journalists were given to understand by their North Korean captors that if somebody came from the U.S., and Bill Clinton apparently was mentioned in person and by name, that would go well for them. And they, when the two journalists telephoned their families, as they were allowed to do from time to time back there in California, this was conveyed.
So you're saying that the idea always was that they were hostages and there would be a quid pro quo and that the North Koreans implied that Bill Clinton would do. Why? Remind us why. And especially in light of recent events, just 2 weeks ago, Hillary Clinton compared North Korea's missile launches and nuclear tests to the actions of an attention-seeking teenager. The North Koreans then called her remarks vulgar and said she was a funny lady who was neither intelligent nor diplomatic. So we've had these words exchanged. So why would the North Koreans be so eager for Bill Clinton to come?
The thing is, it's a complex relationship. The North Korea, from its side, I mean, goodness knows, we don't know for sure, particularly at the moment, what they want. They've been very militant of late and so forth. But they, you know, the idea of somebody as senior as President Clinton coming, being there on North Korean soil, meeting Kim Jong-il, the North Koreans like that sort of stuff. Call it face, call it status, call it what you will.
Well, you're one of those who said that Bill Clinton, in many ways, is the one they've been waiting for. It's sort of a relationship that got stymied, and they want to reenact. Remind us, because Bill Clinton was part of reaching the so-called agreed framework of 1994. So just briefly remind us what happened during his administration.
Sure, I'll do my best to be brief. I mean, we have been round the block with the North Koreans a lot of times, it must be said. But basically, within the fateful year of 1994, Bill Clinton then, you know, who hadn't been that long in office, went from a nuclear crisis in the May when he seriously considered bombing the Yongbyon nuclear complex, that's North Korea's main nuclear complex, through the dramatic intervention, which in a curious way he's now sort of reprised by another ex-president, Jimmy Carter. It was all quite dramatic. But quite importantly, nuclear talks starting, and by, I think, October of the same year, a thing called the Agreed Framework, which basically put the North Korean nuclear program, or most of it, in the can for a while. It then all unraveled under Bush, but that's another story unless you want to go there.
And yet Bush supporters wouldn't put it that way. They'd say that during the Clinton era, there was too much appeasement, too much compromise. And so how is this being framed now?
Well, it's true that this is very contentious. And almost the moment the agreed framework was signed, Newt Gingrich led the Republican landslide and got control of Congress, and they did their best to undermine it. History will be the judge. I mean, for my money, and not sort of trying to take an ideological stance, simply a practical one on the matter, under Clinton, the nuclear program that the North Koreans definitely had was all in the can. It wasn't, unfortunately, dismantled and disabled, but it was under lock and key. Maybe the North Koreans did indeed have, as I think they've now admitted, a uranium enrichment program on the side for reasons that maybe he will explain one day. President Bush decided he would go for that one. He sent a delegation to Pyongyang in 2002, confronted them about that. There was bad blood. The North Koreans kicked out the IAEA, restarted Yongbyon, and 3 years later we got a nuclear test. I think it was better when the stuff that we knew about was in the can than now when it's abroad and we have a huge problem.
That's Aidan Foster Carter, an expert on Korea and an honorary senior research fellow at Leeds University in England, weighing in on today's news from North Korea. Aidan, thanks so much.
That's a pleasure. Thank you.
Our conversation today is a tough one. It's about kids and bullying and suicide, but it comes with a lot of hope about what parents and schools can do. Serdina Walker says her almost 12-year-old son, Carl, killed himself last April because he was bullied at his Springfield, Massachusetts middle school. A recent Yale University compilation of 37 studies from 13 countries shows that victims of bullying and bulliers are at increased risk of depression and suicide. And now the American Academy of Pediatrics is urging pediatricians to get more involved. One of the lead authors of their new policy statement is in the studio with us, Dr. Robert Sege. He's chief of ambulatory pediatrics at Boston Medical Center. Dr. Sege, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we also welcome Serdina Walker, Carl's mother. She recently testified at a congressional hearing on strengthening school safety, and she joins us on the line from her home in Springfield. Serdina, your son's picture was in the paper. He was a beautiful boy. We are so sorry for your loss.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Tell us, as much as you want to, more about what happened. We understand you were even on your way to talk to his school yet again when you found him?
He had had an incident that day at school, and he was describing to me what happened. His life was threatened. That was the first Monday of the month, and we usually have our PTO meetings.
Yeah.
So I was on my way to a PTO meeting, and I was going to bring Carl with me.
This is the Parents Teachers Organization.
Right. My intention that night was to take Carl with me to the PTO meeting because I knew that the director of the charter school would be there and that we could come to the bottom of what happened that day.
And we need to stress again, this wasn't new. This had been going on for a while. You had talked to the school before.
He was having problems. I asked him what the problem was. He told me that there were some children that were, calling him names.
What were they calling him?
You think you're gay. You act like you're gay. Those were the main words that they were calling him.
And we should be, this is a 12-year-old who wasn't even sure about his sexual identity.
Well, at the time he was 11, he was just a great, fun-loving kid. He loved life. He loved the church. He loved the Lord. He was a Boy Scout. He played football, soccer, and basketball. And, he hadn't even reached puberty.
And as we know, this sort of used as a slur has become real popular in schools. It's a pejorative that's even been endorsed by people like conservative columnist Ann Coulter. You know, you're so gay. And they were saying it to him, and it seems like it escalated. What happened?
I think what happened was Carl really became tired of his environment. He didn't really see that there was any changes being made, even though I contacted the school on a regular basis. I asked the guidance counselor to become involved. He met with the guidance counselor once a week. I even talked to Carl's pediatrician at his yearly physical. Carl was an honor roll student. His problem was the environment that was at the school. I found Carl, and Carl actually committed suicide by hanging himself with an extension cord outside of his room, and I found him. the first instinct is to try to save your child. Mm. You know, I actually cut the extension cord myself, and my niece performed CPR on Carl until the emergency personnel came to my home.
In your wildest nightmares, did you think that this... I mean, you were obviously worried. You'd been speaking to the school. Did you think this was possible?
No, I did not think this was possible, only because I emphasized to Carl that he comes from a great family, friends, at church, at home. We really loved him, and I always told him, not to fight back, but to inform the teacher, administrator, that children were bothering you.
Yeah. Let's bring in Dr. Sege. Dr. Carl was 12 years old. We read about a child in the Chicago area who committed suicide last year. His parents called his death a bullicide. How common is this?
I think that suicide is unfortunately uncommon. But what we do know about teen suicide, and I guess preteen suicide, is that kids are very impulsive. When an older person kills him or herself, they often spend 6 months thinking about it before they make their decision and plan. What we know about teen suicide is they often decide and do something within an hour. Mm-hmm. That's very dramatic, and this is obviously a very sad story. He was at the peak age when bullying really sort of peaks around 6th grade, maybe 5th grade, and then gradually gets better after that because kids find other things. And I think that many aspects of the story we heard really sound pretty classic for bullying.
Well, Serdina, we're going to ask Dr. Sege more about what he has concluded in the paper he's a lead writer on, but did people say to you, well, kids will be kids, this is, kids have to get through this, it's a rite of passage, as he said, bullying is a part of life at this age?
I am so determined to make this my platform for the rest of my life because it's so preventable, because that's what I was told in so many words, that this is a rite of passage. When I went to the parent-teacher organization, I joined the parent-teacher organization because my son was having problems in the school, and I felt like I could put my energies towards this school. I have three other children, and I felt like this school needed my help the most. When I talked to the directors and the teachers there, and I mentioned that, this is going on, what they told me was, this happens in the sixth grade, but by seventh grade, everybody's the best of friends. Well, I want to tell everybody, the listening audience, that my son is not going to be there in seventh grade in September.
Yeah.
That's why I'm so urgent and vigilant, and I'm so excited and happy that the American Academy of Pediatrics has come out with this report, because this is not a rite of passage. It should not be that way.
Well, let's talk more about the report. Dr. Sege, Carl's mother, Serdina Walker, went to her pediatrician. She talked to the teachers. So what are you recommending that doctors can do that obviously wasn't done?
The statement calls on pediatricians to ask kids about bullying, to ask them how school is going, not just academically, but also what their experience of school is like. Mm-hmm. And I think that everything was kind of done right in a way from mom's point of view. She went, sought help from the doctor. She went to the school. And interestingly, it's not the school teacher who can help, because usually bullying doesn't happen in the classroom. It happens elsewhere at the school. What we're asking pediatricians to do is to ask about that, to give parents information on how they can help their children if they're victims, how they can help their children if they're bullies.
That's important. You say bullies need help too. We'll get to that. But here are some of Dr. Sege's thoughts on helping victims. He says get them involved in programs outside school where the bully isn't present. That's key to improving self-esteem. Pediatricians should hand out the American Academy of Pediatrics pamphlet, Bullying is Not Okay, to parents and schools. We'll have a link at our website. Also, some kids, like children with Asperger's, may not pick up on social cues and they become targets. The doctor says pediatricians need to point families to programs where those kids can learn social skills. Dr. Sege is with the Boston Medical Center. We'll be back with him and with Serdina Walker, who again says her son's suicide was prompted by bullying. When we come back, how to help the bullier and why we need to. That's in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about bullying with Serdina Walker, whose sixth grader committed suicide after relentless bullying at school, and Dr. Robert Sege of Boston Medical Center, lead author of a new policy statement on bullying from the American Academy of Pediatrics. And Dr. Sege, one of the things the policy does is implement a model that's been very successful in Europe, which is way ahead of the U.S. on this. It includes identifying three participants, bully, victim, and bystander. Tell us about that.
Yeah, a guy named Dan Olveus, who's a social psychologist from Norway, developed this program, and it was in response to suicides in Norway, trying to figure out what's going on and how to fix it. His big insight was that there are bullies, there are victims, but most of the kids are bystanders, and successful programs mobilize those bystanders and change the culture at the school.
And mobilize them to do what? Because that's scary when you're in sixth grade. Mm-hmm. Bullies are scary, and for you to step in and between a bully and a victim, you become a victim. What should they do?
What happens is that when the school goes through a program like this, the kids feel that the victims are kids who they can protect, and bullies have a problem. Because what happens is when the bully's in charge, the bully's okay, and the kids they're picking on, they have pimples, they have freckles, they wear glasses, and the bullies work by socially isolating their victims. But this program and others like it work by having the other kids say, we have a safe environment. Whatever you're like, you can be okay here. And
Flip it around,
yeah. And the bully has a problem.
Yeah.
And they do it by having...
Well, the bully does have a problem.
Yeah. The other thing we know from the research, which is fascinating, is that in the long run, the bullies have really serious problems. They're less likely to finish school. They're less likely to hold down a job, and they're less likely to have a family of their own or other stable adult relationships, because this behavior that they like as being a bully doesn't work when you grow up.
Well, Sir Dean, I was going to ask you about that. Dr. Sege saying the bullies would isolate their victims. It sounds as if your son Carl might have been a perfect target because he was such a great, beautiful kid, you know, from everything we've seen, and maybe made just... by his very existence made these bullies feel less than or something. But I'm wondering, have you met or spoken to any of them? And has the school talked to them about what's happened since Carl died?
Well, the school has not really communicated with me except for offering their condolences. There was an investigative report that was done, but I never received a copy of it. I've never talked to the bullies or the children that, you know, bothered Carl. The bystanders were the ones that came up to me afterwards, and they were in different grades, and some of them were in Carl's class. And they said to me that, you know, Carl was such a great kid, but they picked on him so much.
I can't imagine that this isn't going to negatively impact those kids who were bystanders as well, that for the rest of their lives, that this happened on their watch.
Definitely.
Dr. Sege, you said bullies are also pediatric patients, are at higher risk of suicide, depression, future unemployment, violence. So how should a pediatrician address a bully?
It's a little bit harder for us because often the victims will, we can eventually figure out that someone's a victim. Figuring out someone's a bully is a little bit harder. And I had a case in my own practice where a mother came to me and said, the principal is picking on my son. When we dug a little bit deeper, her son was, in fact, a bully. And those parents need support in learning how to set limits for the children. And it requires the parents to really play an active role in doing that.
How would a doctor even pick up in his office that someone was a bully?
Well, in the case that I talked about, I heard the story. I didn't really think the principals were likely to pick on a particular child. It's not what they generally do. Mm-hmm. I spoke with the principal. I figured this out. It wasn't that complicated. And then I had the child and the mom come back and speak with me. And I spoke fairly frankly with them about the situation, and then I was worried about her child's future.
I'm imagining there are very few kids who are bullies without something happening to them at home or something else happening in their lives to make them bullies. So you now are really potentially unraveling a ball of twine here.
Yeah, I think whenever you look into a situation, there's a potential for that. Sometimes it's a very simple situation where parents just aren't effective and are themselves bullied by the child because they aren't very effective parents. Other cases, like you said, where there's a lot more going on.
So, Sir Dean, Dr. Sege, talking about working with bullies, telling them they have the problem and they're going to have more problems down the road. But do you think they should otherwise be singled out?
I would like for the school to acknowledge that they have a problem. And I would like the school, once you acknowledge that you have a problem, then you can go about trying to solve that problem. I have been working on the federal level with the Safe Schools Improvement Act, where teachers have professional development and training, that they also have defining what harassment and bullying is, and that also there's data that's been collected regarding who is bullying and who are the children that are being bullied, and then what programs could help, you know, to solve this problem. You don't know what's going on in the school that your child attends unless you go there and you visit.
And we've already talked about what happened in your case. You know, Carl told you everything. He came to you. You went to the school. But what would you, if you were to meet one of the kids that was the bully, what would you want to say to them?
Well, first of all, I would definitely forgive the child, because we are talking about, you know, a child. And we're talking about, you know, a child that probably doesn't feel very good about him or herself. Because I always told Carl that. I said, people that usually do this, you know, they really are not probably happy. They don't have a happy home life. And you do. So I would embrace that child. And I would want, you know, to talk to the parents and probably try to find out how we could help that child. Because if we try to help that child, then that child will have a successful life and will also stop doing this type of behavior.
That's Serdina Walker, a Springfield parent. Her 11-year-old child, Carl, committed suicide. She says it's after he experienced bullying in school, bullying she was trying to tell the school about. Dr. Robert Sege is chief of ambulatory pediatrics at Boston Medical Center and lead author of the American Academy of Pediatrics' new policy statement on bullying. I want to thank you both for talking to us about this issue.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And again, we'll have information and a link to the pamphlet, Bullying is Not Okay, at our website, hearandnow.org. We'll be back after the latest news here and now. The online message service Twitter is gaining in popularity, but it's also been belittled. Writing in 140 characters or less, that's a reflection of our short attention span. Ah, for the good old days, when people really knew how to write. Oh, do you mean, for instance, 1809, when John Quincy Adams wrote, "Up great parts of the night, wife and child sick, saw nothing, calm day, read Mrs. Grant's letters." That's a diary entry that Adams made 200 years ago during a trip he took to Russia before he became our sixth president. And starting today, the Massachusetts Historical Society is tweeting those entries. Jeremy Dubell is assistant reference librarian at the Massachusetts Historical Society. Jeremy, we understand it was a simple observation from a high school student that got this started.
That's right. It was a student here on a tour in the spring, and at some point we were showing him the line-a-day diaries, these ones where he just writes one line per day, and the student said, "It's like he's using Twitter." Mm-hmm. And we said, "Well, that's true. It kind of is like he's using Twitter." And when we realized that today, the 5th of August, is the bicentennial of his voyage to Russia, we figured the opportunity was too good to pass up.
Well, and you also link to maps that show Adams' progress as he makes that trip. What other things did he write about?
Well, he writes a lot. He writes what he's reading, who's sick. A couple times parts of the ship catches on fire, so he writes about those, what they're seeing, which ships they're seeing. Sometimes they see a whale. They play cards in the evening. They're fascinating little entries.
I love the one you talk about, a ship, part of the ship getting on fire. It's this one here, "Weather fine, wind scanty." He gives the latitude and longitude, then says, "This afternoon I found the caboose on fire."
That's right, yeah.
Just one line. Well, you know, they are like tweets. A couple questions, though. Tweets are everybody in the modern age wanting everyone else to know their every little move. But these were diary entries. Did you have any second thoughts about making them public?
Well, not really. I mean, the Adamses, all the way back to John Quincy's father, knew that their words would be read later on. John Adams writes back to Abigail at some point in the 1770s and says, "Make sure you keep all my letters that I'm sending you." They knew that their letters were going to be read for many generations, and they took great care of their papers, the whole family. We have hundreds of thousands of Adams documents here in the collection.
And what do they tell us? I'm reading another one here. "Passed a schooner," again, latitude and longitude, "severe squall while we were at dinner." Another one, "read Plutarch's Life of Romulus." What do they tell us about, you know, the future president?
Well, it's important to remember that this line-a-day diary is just one of two or three diaries that he's keeping all at once. So he has this line-a-day diary, which we think he used as kind of an index, as sort of an abstract of his day, a summary of his day. At the same time, he's keeping long entries, so two or three pages sometimes each day as well. I mean, I think it was his way of organizing his own thoughts so he could come back to them later and find them.
What does it tell us, though, about his presidential caliber, outside of the fact that he seemed very organized about his thoughts?
He's very organized. I mean, one of the things that I really like about John Quincy Adams is he had such a wide range. I mean, he was interested in everything, from literature to science to he's taking latitude and longitude observations and weather. He was, I think, probably one of our most versatile presidents in terms of his knowledge that he had of just such a huge range of topics. Yeah. He and Jefferson probably share the prize there.
Do you have a couple more you'd like to share with us, the tweets?
Let's see. He talks a lot about, let me find that. I really like the second one. "Thick fog, scanty wind, on George's bank, what he's reading, Massillon's Carame servant sermons, and the ladies are sick." There's a sort of famous passage in the long diary where he realizes that he's packed the wrong boxes of books, and so he's really annoyed about it. He doesn't mention it in the line a day, and he just picks up the other books that he has and reads them. But But in the long diary, he complains endlessly about having packed the wrong boxes of books.
You mean he didn't mean to bring Plutarch's Life of Romulus?
He might not have, yeah. Yeah, he might not have. It was sort of what came to hand.
That's Jeremy DeBell. He's assistant reference librarian at the Massachusetts Historical Society. They are now tweeting John Quincy Adams' one-line diary entries. By the way, what kind of impact do you think this will have on young people who tweet and their sense of, as you call them, JQA?
Yeah, we'll see. You know, we decided to do this project, and we weren't really sure what would happen. This morning, we have 3,200 followers on Twitter. You know, this is a way to reach out to a technophilic generation in a new and different way. Using the exact words. We're not editing them, we're just putting them out there. Yeah. And so far, so good, I think.
Jeremy, thanks so much.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you.
Quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, singer Reuben Blades and his life and singing partner, Luba Mason. Beautiful music tomorrow from them. We'll be back in 30 seconds with the mayor of Elkhart, Indiana. President Obama is visiting his town again today. 30 seconds, Here and Now. We have a lot of news related to cars. Lawmakers may vote as early as today to add a $2 billion extension to the government's Cash for Clunkers program, which offers car buyers rebates for their gas guzzlers to apply to the purchase of higher mileage cars. And if the program can just be extended for a year, there may be an ultra-efficient option for car buyers. This week, the Japanese automaker Nissan unveiled its long-awaited electric car, the Leaf, a hatchback with a 100-mile cruising range and a top speed of 90 miles an hour. It's going to hit showrooms in 2010, they say. By the way, tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to hear more about Nissan's entry into the electric car market. Meanwhile, today the new board of General Motors ordered management to bring some of its new vehicles to market faster than planned, and that may include GM's Chevy Volt, a rechargeable electric car. The Volt will be able to go 40 miles on a single charge from a home outlet and then has a small internal combustion engine to generate power after that. Well, electric cars are also on President Obama's mind today as he returns to Elkhart, Indiana, where he'll visit the RV manufacturing company Navistar Monaco to announce $2.4 billion in stimulus grants to support the making of a new generation of electric cars. Unemployment in Elkhart has risen since the president's last visit there in February. The jobless rate is almost 17%, though it has come down a bit from May. That's something the Republican National Committee is seizing on. In an email blast today, the RNC points out that when President Obama was in Elkhart the last time, he said stimulus money would create or save nearly 80,000 jobs in Indiana. But 24,000 jobs have been lost in that state since the stimulus passed. Dick Moore is mayor of Elkhart, Indiana. He's a Democrat. We first spoke with him in February, and I asked Mayor Moore what he's listening for from the president.
He's talking about some new technology, maybe some improvements in battery technology, which is very, very important to the hybrid industry. Navistar Monaco is already in that venture in producing hybrid technology and energy for light-duty vehicles. So he's going to bring some money along in order to boost that, and I think that would be great, too. As you noted, he's come here. His first trip out of the White House was to Elkhart, Indiana. This will be the fourth time that he's come into our area, and we appreciate his interest in our community a lot.
Well, and underscore more why this is so appreciated. We understand that your region was once a capital of RV manufacturing, and, of course, that industry's been hit hard.
Yeah, we've been reliant upon the RV industry here almost forever, it seems. It's been very, very good for us. But when the price of gasoline and fuels went up $4 and $5 per gallon, and when the availability to get bank credit went the other way, the RV industry got caught right in the middle. And, you know, I'm very optimistic that that will come back. Of course, we're trying to diversify here, look for industries that are not reliant upon the RV industry, but we're not turning our backs on the RV industry at all. Putting some people back to work, getting some things done, putting some spending power back in their pockets. That person that wanted that RV for their recreation, for their camping and so forth 15 months ago still wants that vehicle, and I'm confident that if we give them some work, let them earn some money, we're going to go back up in sales and the RV industry is going to be okay.
Well, the last time President Obama was in your area, he said recovery is going to be measured in years, not weeks or months. Given that, I'm just wondering, Mayor Moore, your thoughts on some of the other of the policies coming out of the Obama White House. For instance, health care. There's a huge divide on health care. A lot of people calling it socialism, saying that it's going to be too expensive a program.
Well, you know, I remember beginning of the stimulus program, I believe I'm quoting the president accurately, when he said doing nothing is not an option. I feel the same way about health care. Health care costs are driving this nation into oblivion. Right here in the city of Elkhart, our health care bill for our city employees is over $6.5 million. I'm talking to others in industry who have had to make drastic changes in their health care policies and how they're applying that towards their employees. It is a major issue. Normally, the division of minds along the line of health care is along political lines. We need to keep in mind that doing nothing is not the option. This country needs some kind of a health care plan that will work, and I just give him all the praise that I can for doing something rather than doing nothing.
You mentioned you have a $6.5 million budget for your city employees. I'm just wondering, what's the cost in your area of the unemployed and the uninsured?
I don't know that factor. I know, you know, when we talk about Elkhart, we went to the depths of 20% of our people in the city being unemployed. That means one out of every five of us that could work wasn't working. So, you know, that's an extreme number. But there again, what do you do? What do you do when you're paying extreme amounts for health care when you're working, and what do you do when you're not working? So, you know, something has to give here in the area of health care. I know that one of the things that's happening here is I'm seeing a little bit of recovery, and I'm seeing it sooner than anyone predicted. I think even sooner than the president predicted. I think he's going to get pleasantly surprised that what he's doing is going to be working a little bit quicker than what all of us thought about.
What are you seeing, and what is he doing that specifically that you think is gaining that?
Well, basically, the infusion of money. You know, a few months ago, the only money available in this country was the government money. That's our money. The investors are investing more. They don't do that when bad things are coming out of the White House. The economic indicators are looking a lot better. We're seeing some return to employment here in Elkhart, Indiana, even within the RV industry. We see car lots that are going empty. So many cars are being sold. Those are the things that he's doing. Those are the plans that we're working with today, and they're his plans. And I don't know how anyone can deny that something is happening. Something is turning this around, and I think it's going to be a little bit quicker, and hopefully so, than what a lot of us thought it would be.
Interesting. You say you see car lots emptying. Is that from the Cash for Clunkers program?
Exactly. Yeah.
And where else are you seeing stimulus money? You say the money, the taxpayer money, the government money is coming back to you in the form of stimulus money, government money. Where's it going?
Well, let's just look at this as a nationwide stimulus program. Whenever anybody gets some of this money, and Elkhart, Indiana has received $14 million so far. We're looking at more, but $14 million so far. We just renovated a 6,500-foot-long runway at our municipal airport, put a couple hundred people to work on that job. We're going to start on our combined sewer overflow system remediation, going to put some more people to work on that job. But let's forget about Elkhart, Indiana. Let's say some of that money went to California or it went to New York. However, when those projects begin there, they're ordering some supplies that we make here in Elkhart, Indiana. As I get around my city, we're seeing a lot more people in our restaurants here in the area, talking to retail merchants, telling me sales are up.
Yeah,
it isn't great. It is the word slight fits with it. We're not at the end of the tunnel yet. You know what we're saying here this morning. If I was saying this and a man was looking at me that's been unemployed for 6 or 8 months, you know, he wouldn't understand my optimism.
That's Dick Moore, mayor of Elkhart, Indiana. Mayor Moore, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
You've no doubt seen the ads for age-restricted, child-free communities. Maybe you live in one. In his book Leisureville, now out in paperback, 30-something Andrew Blackman reports that within the next decade, some 12 million people may be living in these child-free communities. His friends and neighbors, the Andersons, moved to a retirement community, the Villages, in Florida.
The Andersons' village is clean and new, with rows of tidy ranch homes ending in quiet cul-de-sac. Lawn sprinklers effortlessly turn on and then off in near unison. The lawns are perfectly edged, and try as I might, I can't find a single weed. The driveways are so clean that they look scrubbed, and in fact, some are. The neighborhood is so immaculate that it resembles a set from Leave It to Beaver, but Wally and Beaver are nowhere to be seen. There are no bicycles or baseball mitts littering the yards. No school buses, no swing sets, no children playing street hockey. For that matter, there are no children. There aren't even any young couples holding hands. Aside from the droning of a distant lawnmower, the neighborhood is ghostly silent.
We spoke with Andrew Bleckman last year when Leisureville was first published. He'd written that he was surprised that the Andersons had moved, and I asked him why.
Well, they seemed like neighborhood lifers. They didn't seem like the type that move. They had a perfect house for aging in place and a wonderful neighborhood in which they seemed to be very happy in. In fact, they never thought they would move, but when they went down for a vacation to Florida, they stayed at a place called The Villages, and they just absolutely fell in love with it.
And you described them before that as being the kind of elderly couple we're familiar with, you know, with the time to keep and maintain lawns and shrubs and keep them immaculate and maybe wander over and offer advice to the young homeowner with crabgrass across the street. That would be
yes.
You. But then in reading along, I have this picture in my mind, and I'm stunned, and I think this is sort of key to your book, I'm stunned when you casually say they are 55 and 62. These are not old people.
No, they're not. In fact, that's exactly what this book is really about. It's really nothing short of a sociological revolution. The folks that are going to these Leisurevilles are really just middle-aged. The entry age is 55.
And you discovered just how big this place that they've moved to is. It's called The Villages. Describe it.
It's the world's largest retirement community. It's gated. Children are allowed to visit, but they're not allowed to live there.
They're only allowed to visit for a certain amount of days, too, right?
Absolutely. In fact, if they visit, they're basically given a guest pass, and that guest pass times out like an international visa.
You have to leave, as did you. You had a visa as well as someone
yes.
who is way under 55. Well, you're soon pulled into the history of these retirement communities. Just briefly give us the overview. When did they start?
This started basically in the 50s, more or less with Sun City as well as Youngtown right next to it.
In Arizona.
In Arizona, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It was basically an invention by a developer.
You lived for a while with your former neighbors, the Andersons, at The Villages. What was that like for you?
Well, first of all, they have 100 miles of golf cart trails. Secondly, they have two manufactured downtowns where they have historical plaques that make it look like it's about 200 years old. And in fact, the plaques look 200 years old. It's very well done. It was actually themed by entertainment specialists out of Universal Studios. And everywhere you go, the music, the golden oldies, as well as headlines are pumped out of lampposts and fake rocks.
So the whole town, this
wired
huge town is wired for sound.
Yeah, wired for sound.
What happens? So these people pay taxes?
Yes, for the most part they do, but there's a lot of discomfort with paying school taxes. And I always point to what happened to Sun City as the canary in the coal mine. Sun City in the early days defeated 17 school bond measures in 12 years.
Which impacted the neighboring towns that were in the same county.
Oh, not just the same county. I mean, sometimes across the street.
So if towns have these retirement villages clustered around them, any school issues are going to plummet.
Well, it can. It's not always the case. I mean, some of these communities are a lot smaller, and some of them seem to care about their surroundings. But by and large, they generally don't like school bond measures, and they can defeat them. I mean, in The Villages, they've basically taken over. In fact, they have taken over the county, and they're looking to cut taxes and not fund public parks as much, or you know, ball fields or schools or anything for that matter that families enjoy.
Because everything within the confines of The Villages, for instance, staying with The Villages, they pay for through amenities fees.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't need the town to build them a park or a pool. It's all part of their buying into these communities.
It's the same argument. You know, if you send your kid to private school, you know, all of a sudden you complain that you're paying taxes for the public schools. You know, and I tell people, look, no one likes paying taxes, but if you don't want to pay taxes, move to Somalia. They don't have any there.
Well, as we're starting to hear, you really, you know, didn't like what you started to see in The Villages. And again, you'd gone down to visit your neighbors who'd moved there. You started to see at least one group that was, well, you know, had a very active sex life. Nothing wrong with that. There was a fellow named Mr. Midnight, which we won't even tell you. You know, I got the name. He pops Viagra, makes dates with women round the clock. That's what he does, is go to the dating bars. And, very affable fellow. But there was a huge singles, acceptable one-night stand dating scene that you stumbled on.
Well, STDs are actually the elder communities is the highest growing demographic for getting sexually transmitted diseases, because at that age you don't get pregnant, so why use protection? It's false to say that that's all that goes on. There's plenty of people that wake up at the crack of dawn to play golf or maybe go to some sort of poetry class, but there is quite a nightlife. I mean, it's basically college campus with no classes. I mean, everyone's your age. Every day is Saturday night. You could sleep late. You could play maybe a quick round of golf, maybe, I don't know, sit by the pool, and then go out. And, you know, you drive your golf cart home. No one's going to stop you. So it can go on pretty late. I mean, I went to one after-hours karaoke bar where people were hanging out and really kicking it until 1:30 in the morning.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this. Coupled with many of the quotes that you use from people telling you why they like the place, I mean, your former neighbor, the wife, says to you, it's like the Stepford Wives. Everyone's smiling all the time, but she's not, there's no irony in that comment. And the Washington Post gave you a great review. Jonathan Yardley writes, one can only imagine what the late Jane Jacobs, the great evangelist for natural communities, would have thought of the villages. But Janet Maslin in the New York Times writes that your book is like shooting geriatric fish in a barrel. Does she have a point? You know, was it fair to focus so much on the people sleeping around in these communities?
You know, it's interesting. I don't feel like I did. I really don't. I have one chapter called Mr. Midnight, and I actually put that in there because I like the way that it smashed stereotypes that we have of people growing older.
And elder communities, because, again, these are not 80 to 90-year-olds. These are
they're not
younger people.
They're basically middle-aged people who don't want to be around children for the most part and who are looking for community, I should say. That's just as strong.
Well, and you are very clear that you're a young person who's just started raising your children. Mm-hmm. And you wonder, maybe it's just me that I'm resenting this. I'm resenting my children being so vilified by some of these people who just, you know, are adamant they don't want to be around kids. But, you know, don't they have the right? They also say to you, I've raised kids. I've raised my kids' kids. It's stressful, and I need a break. It's my turn now.
I can fully understand why people move there. I really do. But I do worry that what happens, I mean, look, it just comes at a price. I guess, you know, people can agree with the book, they can disagree with the book, but what I'd like to do is start a debate about this, because 12 million people are expected to live this way, and that's a conservative number in the next decade or so. The question is this, I mean, when do things start to fall apart? You know, I mean, what's the message being passed on to the next generation? You can secede, but what's going to happen to the younger generations whose school districts aren't being as well-funded, who don't have elders around as mentors and role models? What's going to happen to these generations when they grow up and it's up to them to decide whether they want to continue Social Security payments, Medicare and Medicaid? You know, I mean, we all have to depend on each other.